The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbound to join the folks who make the show possible and to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is Chris Pepin Neff, the world's foremost expert on human-shark interactions. His life was shaped, you will be shocked to hear, by the movie Jaws, but it was also shaped by his time in a socialist commune, as well as working alongside Frank Kameny, one of the leading gay rights activists of the 20th century, not to mention Chris's friendship with Gore Vidal. Chris has so many fascinating stories to share, and I am so excited to bring them to you. But first, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. And don't forget to check out my other shows. Culture Cruise on YouTube is a deep dive into queer entertainment milestones. I just posted a video about the 90s sitcom Dinosaurs, and its unlikely link to a real-life gay Transylvanian dinosaur hunter from the 1800s. And check out Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two narrative comedy shows with drag heroes going on adventures in a world of fantasy. Now, here's Chris. Well, this week I'm speaking with Chris Pepin Neff. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Matt. I'm super excited to be here. This is, I'm geeking out. This is great.
Yay, awesome. So tell me, what is the entertainment that changed your life?
It would have to be Jaws. Like, I was 8 and I was laying on my parents' carpet and, you know, the shark comes out of the water and I just exploded. The popcorn went everywhere. I knocked over a bowl. I made a cardboard cutout of a shark. I taped it to my wall. I went to the library and got all the shark books. And then sort of, eight. So flash forward to being 30 and doing a PhD on the politics of shark attacks.
Tell me about how the shark, like, just took over your life. Like, you mentioned the, like, getting stuff in the library and the cardboard cutout and stuff. Did you just have, like, a super shark-centric lifestyle as a kid?
It was interesting. It was kind of in the closet. Like, people didn't get it. There wasn't a thing. There wasn't shark social science didn't exist. I didn't want to be a marine biologist. I didn't want to be an oceanographer. Those seemed scary and hard. I wanted to, like, do a survey of the mayor of of Amity Island and find out, like, what makes him tick and why the people were scared. And so we would, like, when we go to beaches and stuff, like, I was in New England, so we'd go to, you know, super cold Musquamicket Beach in Rhode Island and things like that. And that was definitely my thing. And no one was surprised. I did Shark Week one year. And in fact, the episode that I was sort of featured in was called How Jaws Changed the World. And nobody was surprised. Everybody sort of sat around and watched it. And they're like, okay, he's sort of been a shark guy for a long time.
But your interest was more in what the sharks did for the for people rather than, like, how do sharks work and where do they come from?
Totally. Yeah. I thought the people angle and the shark bite angle was more interesting.
Before you really became before you grew up and became an expert in this stuff, how did you basically bring those interests into your life? Like, I imagine if a kid's like, oh, I'm really interested in marine biology, adults know what to do with that kid. But if you're like, I'm interested in public policy as, like, you know, a 12-year-old, what form did that take for you?
I was super political. Again, like, I would watch Jabberjaw. Like, it wasn't, nobody knew what to do with it. It wasn't a thing. So I just ended up being a super political kid. Everybody said, oh, he's going to run for president. You know, the way, like, there's one student in every middle school class and they're like, hey, one day he's going to be like, and I was the little gay kid. Obsessed with sharks, who was going to be president one day.
How gay are we talking here? Like, was this something that you were aware of or just, like, people around you knew about you?
I didn't know. Like, I didn't come out till I was 20, had an idea at 16. No idea before that. Like, I was super gay. I just was. But
it, well, in what way? Like, what made you so gay?
You know, and it's more than, like, your mannerisms or sort of, you know, where put it, I wore makeup, I did drag, The whole town sort of revolted against me doing drag. I wore it to the town hall, like the Halloween festival, and got really, not picked on, but was given a hard time. And then before I even knew I was gay, I was sort of targeted for bullying, and I had to go to a different school because I would not have survived my middle school, high school years. So like it would have been bad. So I went to a different school. So like before I even knew, could sort of consciously put my finger on all this stuff, the world around me was sort of moving.
Do you remember what the Halloween drag costume that you wore was?
Oh, totally. I have a picture. I'm happy to send it. It was, I look good.
Mm-hmm.
I had a big fluffy sort of Cruella de Vil jacket on, with overdone makeup, Tammy Faye makeup. Tammy Faye Baker, for those who don't know, and I'm sure everyone does, and a Bea Arthur wig. So I had a Bea Arthur wig, a Cruella de Vil jacket, and Tammy Faye Baker makeup. I looked amazing.
That sounds great. What inspired you to go and drag? Like, was it something you wanted to do?
I liked it. I thought it was really cool, and I didn't know I was making a statement that was going to get me in trouble. I just thought it was really great. I felt super comfortable. I think gender play as a general rule is super comfortable. And I was at my friend Tim Lucassen's house. Tim Lucassen, by the way, is an actor in Hollywood now. A really good one. What's my point? Oh, Tim's mom put me in, did my makeup. And went out and we had a great time. So like it was spontaneous, but super comfortable.
And then it sounds like the reception from strangers was not as welcoming.
No, they were pissed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, like where do you go from there when you get a message like, no, you can't do this? Like, did that make you dig in your heels and want to do it even more?
No, I didn't tell anyone. And everybody asked how it went. And I didn't say anything, and the town didn't talk about it. Like, it was considered really foreboding. Like, it was a thing.
Wow. But you still had the shark thing, right? Like, how were you going to, like, I don't know, marine biology things? Or how are you getting involved in sharks as a teenager?
I was reading books about what I sort of have spent my life's work, at least in my shark stuff, getting rid of the word shark attack. I wrote a journal article that was in on NPR where we sort of renamed shark bites and human shark interactions. And like, I just read everything about shark attacks and every book that was out there. And it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I thought it seemed like people were overreacting. Politicians were being crazy. None of their solutions were going to work. Then it was being sensationalized. You had all these, you know, interesting movies. Like, it was Jaws, and then there was Paws and Claws, and then there was an Orca movie that came out. And, like, so, and then there was Cujo that was sort of in that, like, early 1980s vein. I think that's Danny Pintaro. I was just trying to make sense of it all.
Do you have a sense of why it was that sharks really capture you and not, say, like human-bear interactions?
Oh, that's a really good question. Because I did a paper on humans and lions, and my teacher said the exact same thing to me. She's like, you don't really like humans and lions. And I was like, no, I don't. And I had done research on humans and alligators, and it just, I mean, it's interesting. I think the science and the social science is interesting, but I didn't really care. The sharks, it got me. I thought sharks were misunderstood. I mean, my research, I'm on the side of the shark, like, to be perfectly blunt about it. Like, I think sharks get a bad rap. I think humans need to be more careful when we go in the ocean. And all of my research is sort of about how sharks are misunderstood.
Do you think of the ocean, like having researched sharks this much, as like an inviting place, or is it more complex? Is it like there's the mix of an ocean is beautiful but also dangerous?
No, I mean, I think the ocean is the wild, and the bear thing is a really good analogy. Like, when people are, you know, run into a bear, that scene, like, you entered their territory. You're in their domain. You wear a bell, you know, to sort of, you put your, what is it? You leave the food in the car, or you string it up, or you bury it, or whatever you do with the food. Like, but you try to figure out how to navigate in their universe. And the ocean is seen like a beach. It's like a resort. You go with your kids, you throw them in the water for 3 hours, you know. That's not what the ocean is. It's something completely different that's been domesticated, like, politically and socially for, like, tourism dollars. And you're essentially invading, like, nature's territory.
Yeah, do you find yourself reluctant to go into the ocean?
I go in really conscious that I am an alien going in the ocean, that I don't belong here. I am a land animal. We're all land animals going into the ocean. And so, you know, from my point of view, when I go in with respect, and I'm really careful. I was in South Africa scuba diving with Sarah Fowler, who's probably the best shark scientist in the world. And two things happened. One was she tapped me on the shoulder and she pointed at the 400 box jellyfish that were swimming just about 30 meters above us. And that is a problem for anyone who knows what a box jellyfish is. Like, it's the most dangerous creature on the planet Earth. The pain is so extreme that even while unconscious, you scream. So it's sort of a special kind of death. And so there was this whole school of them. And so we laid on the bottom of the ocean and I ran out of oxygen because I had never sort of been in that situation before. So I surfaced and I was 1,000 meters from the boat. And this was in white shark waters. It's their waters. It's not my waters. And I had to swim 1,000 meters, which is like whatever, 3,000 feet. And halfway there, I just started to flail and I screamed to the guy, like, get me out of the boat, get me into the boat. It can be like, so I go between respect for the ocean and the sharks and get me out of the water. So I like lakes and, some rivers, like, but when it comes to the ocean itself, like, I'm super careful.
What was your education like when you went to college and you decided this was something you wanted to study? I imagine there weren't a lot of people doing this kind of work, or at least not like the work from the angle and the interest that you had.
When I was doing my master's degree, I sent an email to the to all of the shark scientists in the world. So it wasn't that big of a list. Like, it was about 75 of them. And they were like the leading people because I didn't know who the postdocs were and the junior scientists. So I sort of did everybody who'd written a book. And I said, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to look at social science. I'm going to do a master's and a PhD. I said, if you have any thoughts about this, I should talk to, or if anybody knows of any grants or any money, like, you know, please let me know. And I got a note back from all of them. And they all said, you're crazy. There's no money. And this isn't a field. It's not real. And they were being well-meaning. I was the crazy post-grad who was coming to them with this idea, and they didn't want my hopes to be dashed in a year or for me to accrue this debt. And so they were just being sort of the straightforward shark scientists that they are. And so without tooting my own horn, I had to invent a field of study. And today it probably fits most comfortably under something like marine sociology, which is all Peter Jakes invented that field. And that's, I'm not a sociologist, so I don't think it fits perfectly, but it's something like that. So yeah, no, you know, just like nobody liked me in drag, nobody really liked me in, human shark interactions.
What was your goal with a master's and a PhD? Was it, like you said, to take that shark attack and like get that idea out of people's head that they're coming after us and make them seem more, I don't know, sympathetic?
I wanted to change the world. I mean, the goal was to change the underlying power dynamic so that the sort of the world understood that there was something wrong, that whatever had happened had led us astray, so that we saw sharks as evil and the beach as a pool, when really it's the wild and sharks belong there and we're the invaders. And we shouldn't call them attacks. They're not attacks. And I did this TED talk about it, this TEDx event in Sydney. Like, and so I did the history and went back to Linnaeus. Linnaeus invented sort of, so the Latin for every, the index of species. So Linnaeus came up with Carcharidae and Carcharias and all of the, every species that's been named was originally named by Linnaeus. And so I like went back to like 400 years ago to look at the construction of the human shark relationship. And I was like, this is really not, it's not accurate. It's just not correct. There's a lie. The whole world has been told a lie about sharks and a lie about ourselves. And so I want to fix it. That's what I want to do with my life. I want to solve this global conspiracy.
So how do you do that? Like, now that you are established as an expert, what do you do with your research? Where do you bring it?
Really good question. So it's sort of split into three parts, right? So the first is the academic stuff. So I wrote a book in 2019, which is sort of the culmination of all of my research. It's called Flaws, and that's the academic book. So that's what, you know, academics are supposed to do. You write your book. And then I'm doing this really interesting research. So for instance, I did a study in Cape Town. So my job, the second bit, is to do like groundbreaking research that no one's ever done before to make the point. Because otherwise, I'm just the crazy guy who thinks he's changing the world. So I need really interesting data to back me up on an issue that people don't necessarily believe exists. So I went to a beach, to Fishhook Beach, and I surveyed how people felt about sharks, seals, and dolphins. Then there was a shark bite at the beach, like 6 months later. So I flew back to Cape Town and surveyed again. And it's the first before and after. Like, you don't, this data doesn't exist. You don't get to go back to the beach where the shark bite happened. And it showed that people didn't take it out on the shark. They took it more out on the seal that was swimming by the guy than they did on the shark. So there was that. Then I did a study in I'll be quick about this. I did a study in an aquarium, in Sydney Aquarium, where people walked around the shark exhibit that was under, like, you know, like a shark tunnel, and surveyed how they felt looking at the shark. And people basically said that when they thought sharks bit them intentionally, it made them very afraid. But upon seeing the shark and how it basically ignores them when they walk through the shark tunnel, their fear went down and their support for like policies and conservation of sharks went up. So the data is really, and then I did the one on Jaws and I did an article called The Jaws Effect. So I'm trying to destabilize the sort of intellectual conversation that's going on about sharks.
When you look back at Jaws, the movie that really set the tone for the work you would do, do you look back at that and think, okay, well, here's what they're doing wrong, and here's what I would have done if I was a policy expert on this island?
Yes, absolutely.
What are the changes you would make to, like, obviously the movie would not be as exciting, but what would you do if you were in that scenario?
So I've done this twice. I advised two different governments, the West Australian government, that it had really serious fatalities, and the Reunion Island government, which is an overseas department of the French government that's off the coast of Madagascar. It's one of these colonized communities. And in WA, they hated me. I got a call from the government saying, what they said is, quote, "It smacks of a Sydney academic who doesn't understand how fearful the public is." So I tried and then got smacked down. And then in the second one, I'm going to get to what I would do in just a second. In the second one, it was amazing. We were at this table about to present our results, which are sort of like scientific results. And the mayor, just like in the movie Jaws, turns to me and goes, we're going to kill the shark. And I said, well, that's not what our recommendation is. And she goes, we're going to kill the shark. And I said, then I'm going to leave and walk out on you in the middle of this press conference. And she goes, okay. And we got up and we made our presentation, and that was it. And then they went and killed the shark later. Oh. So I think politics is like hardball. Like it's full contact sports. Unless you inflict a penalty on people, the public doesn't support policies that kill sharks. The public doesn't think sharks are responsible. There's like a rule in ethics. I can't tell you who people think are responsible for shark bites. I can tell you it's not the shark. It's on average about 4% of the public that believes the shark is responsible. And that's in multiple locations around the world. So they don't want to kill the shark. They don't think the shark is responsible. They think shark attack is overused. They think the media is sensationalized. It has nothing to do with the public. It has to do with the weakness of politicians. And like I always say, the sharks are the politicians. So part of what I do as a academic is to be really clear about the data that shows them to be weak. And the second is to try to propose policies that have more support. And I know that's sort of wishy-washy. Basically, I think people should get out of the water if there's a shark. That's it. That's the whole thing. If they see a shark, they get out of the water. And we stay out of the water until the shark goes away. It's like a whale or a school of dolphin or seals or... And sharks aren't special. We treat them as special.
I mean, this reminds me very much of people's reaction to the pandemic that's happening right now, where there's sort of a just stick your head in the sand, pretend it's not a problem. There's a very simple solution. Just avoid contact with the hazardous situation for a while, and that's all you got to do. But it sounds like people are either looking for a scapegoat or they're looking for some solution that will just clear it up instantly, or at least they can pretend that it's been cleared up instantly.
It's like the Homer Simpson episode. You know, if you touch this, you're going to be shocked. And he touches it 5 times.
Sure.
And he keeps grabbing it, and he keeps sort of, you know, the squiggly lines come in. Like, that's how people are with swimming at the beach. Like, you say to them, if I said to you there's red tide, I will not ever go in the beach. If I said to you there's whales, I am not going in the beach, going in the ocean. Seals, no. Dolphins, no. I might look, but I'm not going to go in with them. Sharks? Oh, absolutely. I should have a right to swim. It's the same point you're making, Matt, about like COVID. Like, you know, should I have a right to, you know, when do I get to wear, women should wear veils when they get married. But I shouldn't wear a mask during a pandemic to go to a grocery store. It's just, it's really similar psychological profile. That exists around the way people feel threatened by things. And so I feel threatened by the shark, so I'm going in the ocean. Like, and that's sort of like toxic masculinity. And there's that within the COVID thing, right? Like toxic masculinity about like, what does it mean to be masculine, to wear a mask? Literally,
oh, yeah,
mask,
yeah,
for mask.
There's a bravado that I think is challenged by the idea like, uh-oh, there's something hazardous that I can't like punch or shoot. Therefore, I'm opposed.
Right. Absolutely. Right. I should be able to bring a gun to the beach or whatever it is.
Have you had, I know you described the Australia situation in Reunion Island as a little frustrating. Have you had successes that you're proud of?
I'm sure the answer is yes. Just give me a minute to figure out what it is. I supported the Cape Town program. They did a Shark Spotters program, and there was a very serious fatal shark bite, and I was sort of involved in trying to sustain the program. So there are two issues in Cape Town, and the first is always apartheid, right? Whatever the other issue is, the first should always be racism, and specifically segregation and apartheid and white supremacy. There is a shark spotter program where people sort of sit on the mountainside and look down and can see the sharks and see the people. And when they get too close, they ring a bell. Well, this fatal event happens and all the shark spotters are black. So people start to sort of speak out against shark spotting as a program. And really there's like a latent problem. This also happens in Cape Town when there are black divers who were bitten by sharks or killed by sharks. There was another case. If you're black, you're a poacher who was trying to like take natural resources out of the ocean. If you're white, you're just a swimmer or a scuba diver and an innocent victim of a shark bite. Mm. So I got involved after this terrible thing happens to try to keep the program afloat, which was really a project of showing how good a job the black shark spotters were doing in the face of this pushback that had a lot of racial overtones. So anyway, this is my point. Like, it's all politics. Shark bites, I mean, the politics of shark attacks, what you call it, the media, the news, the newspaper, the black shark spotter, like, it's an amazing thing. And I'm pretty good at, I'm better at politics than I am at teaching. I write a good book, but I'm a pretty good operative.
Yeah. So tell me about the activism that you've done. Cause I know like there's not just the shark stuff, but you've done a lot of lobbying as well.
Yeah. I've worked in queer and trans rights for 20 years. I started, in DC working in, with the Gay and Lesbian Activist Alliance, which was founded by Frank Kameny. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody knows who Frank Kameny is, but
my listeners know who Frank Kameny is.
Okay, good. All right, great. Well, Frank was my mentor and my friend.
We were friends
until he passed away. And Frank got me involved in politics. He came up to me at a meeting and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "Oh, you need to come with me." And so we did that, and we started having dinners together, and we talk about politics. I mean, Frank is just a treasure, and he was a treasure. So we started investigating two trans black women sex workers who were murdered in D.C., and it was very bad. And so we started looking into it. And that was the first political queer and trans activism I ever did. Was sex worker murders. And that really was good for me in terms of what an intersectionally oppressed population, you know, to be a black trans sex worker and have to fight all the things that they had to fight. So that really got me, you know, I sort of realized what an incredibly privileged position I'm in and that I should be leveraging my privilege to redistribute power. Anyway, so I started doing that and I spent all this time. Frank and I would go to, what were they called? Ex-gay ministries. Like, I guess we'd call them conversion therapy now, but 20 years ago it was just ex-gay events and doing marriage stuff and domestic violence. And then I started having a pen pal who got me involved in more stuff. And you're not going to believe this. Are you ready, Matt?
Mm-hmm.
Gore Vidal.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I'm hanging out with Frank Kameny and Gore Vidal. It's absolutely insane. And I had worked in the U.S. Senate for John Warner, who was married to Elizabeth Taylor. And so literally, it was just nuts. And I'm just a kid, just a stupid 25-year-old. Not most 25-year-olds are not stupid, by the way, but I was a particularly stupid 25-year-old. And, so Gore wanted to talk about DC politics, and he'd call me on the phone, and we would, his idea of pen palling was faxing back and forth to his house in Ravello, Italy, and, or later in his life, he moved to LA. And so there was that was going on. And so working on, so, and this is all around Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gays in the military. And Frank was interested in it. Gore was interested in it. John Warner was interested in it. And so I became the first lobbyist in the United States for repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so, and I did that for 9 years. And then once we repealed it, I started working on trans in the military, and did trans in the military for 6 years. And these sort of overlapped my period in academia, and I would do some stuff from Sydney and I'd fly in. And, that was an cause I started it at 24. It was an extraordinary, opportunity. It was cutthroat, though. It's the some of the hardest work I ever did. And I did a survey recently of LGBTQ activists in Australia, South Africa, the US, and the UK. And when asked the question, I'm going to ask you, Matt, when asked the question, what group do you think is the, what was the question? What group do you think is the toughest to get around for equality? Who did they say, Matt?
Gosh, that's a tough one, because I can imagine obstacles for all kinds of groups. You mean like demographically? Like, I don't...
General gay rights, I'd say. So white male cis rights.
So you're asking, like, what group is the hardest to persuade?
Yeah, so I'll give you the options. Okay. The options are anti-gay groups... Okay, anti-queer and trans groups. Queer and trans groups. The media. And let's just say international organizations. Maybe it's like an international pro-choice group or an international anti-gay group. Of those four.
I have a feeling it's going to be something really counterintuitive, like queer people.
Every single country. Every country said the same thing. Queer groups.
That's so strange. So you're saying that queer groups are harder to persuade that equality is necessary than a general population?
That they were more opposed to it. So they didn't think it wasn't necessary. But if I came to you, you're a queer trans group, Matt, for the purpose of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I come to you and I say, Matt, we need to pass a law for LGBT candy companies to get more candy to LGBTQ people. You would work the hardest of anyone to stop me.
Huh. That is really peculiar. What's going on with that?
I was once in a meeting. Okay, I'm going to be careful how I tell this story. I was once in a meeting. Okay, we're going to use the candy example, all right?
Okay.
I was once in a meeting, and I said to someone, I am going to give you $1,000 worth of candy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they turned back to me and they said, if you don't give me $2,000 worth of candy, I'll tell everyone that you hate candy.
Okay. The problem is starting to become clearer to me.
Yeah. Like, it is very interesting. Like, I used to make the joke that I wanted to do something safer than... queer and trans politics. So now I study shark attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really true. I had that meeting 50 times where you were begging to give somebody something and they didn't. I was in a meeting on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And somebody said, oh no, it's not, now's not the time. It took us 7 years to get to repeal. It was not sexy. Lady Gaga came in, which was great. And Calpurnia Adams was always there. If people know who Calpurnia is, she's an amazing trans actress. But like, it was like, if we hadn't started 7 years before, we would not have gotten there. So like, people just, it's turf. It's, there's a bunch of like variables to it. I'm this new book that I've got coming out. Am I allowed to swear on the
on
your podcast? Like, I talk about fuckability. Like, who, like, if somebody hot, what, somebody who's perceived as conventionally hot, so we're talking about white people, and we're talking about male people, and we're talking about cis people, for the purposes of racist, transphobic, sexist society. People say yes to them. Tall people say yes to more than shorter people. Like, I have a disability. Like, it's much harder for me to get a yes out of somebody. But if somebody walks in and looks the part and meets you on the golf course and makes a deal, then it's totally workable. But if you're poor, brown or black, a woman with a disability, like, it is really hard to do it. And so there's this element of fuckability to, if a hot young something walks in, sure, what do we need to do? How do we make this happen?
Mm-hmm.
You want a job? Like, there's a thing. And it exists in the heterosexual community. I have a lot less experience in the heterosexual community, but like, it's big time in queer and trans politics.
You mentioned that you came out when you were around 20, after like a period of time where you like suspected, but you weren't sure, or you just had no idea. What was it that prompted you to come out?
Really come out was I fell in love. The first guy, my first partner, I literally walked in a cafe, looked at him, said, I'm going to be your partner. And that was it. And then 2 years later, like, we were still together. I was lucky. Like, it was crazy. We lived in a gay socialist commune.
Let's talk about that. So you were in the closet, you saw somebody that you just like had an instant connection with. How did you know? Like, why were you so sure?
Oh, it was fireworks. Like, the whole thing lit up. And it was really interesting because when I started dating him, there was a group on campus that that threatened me to do a letter writing campaign home to my parents, that I was like, these crazy things, Matt, I don't understand them, but they wanted to do a letter writing campaign home to my parents to out me, because I wasn't out, but I was dating someone. But I didn't care. Dan was amazing, and I like was starstruck. So he lived in a gay socialist commune because he was a socialist.
Uh-huh.
And
where was this?
This is in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
Okay.
We went to James Madison University, which is coincidentally the most religious public school in America. We raised mice, white mice, for the local pet stores.
Mm-hmm.
For anybody who doesn't live in a commune. So when you live in a commune, you all have a communal job. We had a sister commune in Charlottesville that made hammocks out of hemp to sell to L.L. Bean. And that was sort of their communal job. Ours was to raise mice to sell to pet stores for their anacondas.
Hmm.
And so that was our thing. And then we used the money from that to buy food and pay rent.
I can't believe there's enough money in breeding mice that you were able to keep a commune going.
Okay, 2 points. The first is no one should breed mice. There is no way to control the population.
Uh-huh.
It exploded. It ended up being very bad. We got a cat. We got a couple cats to try to control the mice in the house.
Oh, dear.
That did not work. The poor cats were exhausted. It didn't really work.
Uh-huh.
We did it, but it, yeah. And the second is that there was okay money, but not enough. And I was the only one with a job. We were all working a job, and all labor is valuable. However, I was the only one who was actively engaged in the capitalist system.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went shopping, we all went shopping.
Okay, I see. So it seems like there was a lot of pressure on you there.
There was. I made $18,000 a year in 1990, 1998, and that is not a lot of money, even in 1998.
What kind of a queer education were you getting living in this commune? Like, were you learning about the gay community and gay history and all that stuff?
So a little bit. It was very interesting. Like, we listened to a lot of Tracy Chapman, mm-hmm. who's the lesbian socialist black singer. A lot of anti-war music, a lot of queer and trans movies. Most of it was like through movies like Get Real and Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss and things like that. What's another one? Oh, this is later, but Broken Hearts Club, mm-hmm. Which is not a movie that I enjoyed. But like things like, so we'd watch movies, we'd listen to music, and then just being like out, Dan also ran a group called Harmony, on campus. And I went one time and that was revelatory to sort of be openly anything, was like a really big deal. So I didn't sort of get the history. I will say this, sorry, can I add one more point?
Yeah.
My senior year, the last 2 months, I sort of got consumed with history, and I printed off all of these documents from the web and whatever, and I had them bound at the printer store. It was super nerdy. And all I did was reread the Bowers v. Hardwick case. Hmm. I thought that the argument, the judgment that there is no constitutional right to sodomy, and that gay people, queer people do not exist, that sexual orientation really didn't exist, was so profound. I thought, this is something I need to do. Like, I need to work on this. Because there's nothing wrong with being queer. There's nothing wrong with being trans. And so we need to work on this. And then I literally left there and went and worked in the Senate for, the senator was married to Elizabeth Taylor, and then bumped into Frank Kameny.
Wow. It seems like between the queer activism, especially like looking at a Supreme Court ruling, which is so, ideally has such a heavy basis in fact and evidence. And then with the Shark work as well, a lot of your work has been about collecting evidence to counter people's irrational behavior or beliefs.
Yeah. If I was to draw a line, I would say that is absolutely right. It's about controversies. Like, what is the issue that is totally unwinnable, right? Gays in the military in 1998. It becomes law in 1994. Let's live in a gay socialist commune, then let's deal with gays in the military, and then let's work on convincing people that sharks don't attack. Like, other than that, super easy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it seems like a lot of those things you found success at. Like, we've got gays in the military. We've made a lot of advances from like the 90s to today. Bowers v. Hardwick was overturned. And, you know, I do think people have, I would hope, a more nuanced sympathy for the natural world. I don't know. That's a harder one to quantify.
I'm single, Matt. I see it all as these issues are extraordinary, and to have been sort of associated with any of them, even a small way, like, I'm still wowed by the fact that I knew Frank, or that, you know, Gore would call me at the office. So,
yeah,
like, it's the little things that matter, and to help service members, to be honest, just so that they were having a little bit of a better time. Like, that for me has sort of made it all the difference.
Do you see future issues that you want to focus on? I mean, I'm sure there's still a lot of work to do in the areas that you have been focusing on. Like, what is the next big project, or is there like the big cause that you're still like very focused on?
The next one is sex worker murders. Mm. I think, particularly trans sex worker murders. I think what the judicial system and what police have done to ignore trans sex worker murders and just sex worker murders. You know, I don't know if you, sorry, I'm going to stop saying that. In Paris is Burning, there's that terrible scene at the end, spoiler alert, where something terrible happens. I am still shaken by that situation. And I'm compelled to do something about it. Again, from a place of privilege, like, I don't have to worry about being murdered by my John. Oh, I should also note, Matt, I lived in a sex worker house in D.C. and amazing, amazing, amazing people. And so I think, you know, I think we're 10 years from being with sex workers where we've been with gay rights or queer and trans rights. And I worry about how many people we will be, that we will allow to die in that time and be murdered without investigations, to be stigmatized, to have, to get COVID, to get HIV, you know, to be beaten in an unregulated system, to be assaulted. And anyway, all of it, like, it's profoundly unjust, and we let it happen.
Yeah, so it seems like 10 years, I mean, honestly, that seems optimistic to me when we talk about, like, the dealing with the stigma that's been internalized within the system for sex work. Like, we see, you know, I see Human Rights Campaign has a great I think it's a, I can't remember if it's a policy paper or something like that, about how there's this vicious cycle of stigma that contributes to violence, and the violence isn't addressed because of stigma. And yeah, that seems like a really difficult thing. You talked about destabilizing the connection between shark attacks and people's use of the ocean. It seems like there's even more to destabilize if you want to address violence against sex workers.
I think that's right. But I will say that I think there's something. I think when you talk about destabilization, that's exactly what needs to happen. That the line from stigma to stigma, and we see this with HIV, is pretty specific. And we see it with people with a disability. It's pretty specific. And so you just need to interrupt it. I'm kind of like the Bobby Kennedy of whatever it is that I do. And I try to be a real asshole. Like, I'm not here to negotiate on gays in the military. I'm not here to negotiate on trans in the military. I'm not here to negotiate about shark bites. And I am not asking for your permission on the issue of sex worker violence. So, you know, and to be quite blunt, like, my years in working in the Senate and working in politics, I've also worked for presidential campaigns. You know, this is about exerting real pressure. I'm not interested in negotiating and spending 10 years negotiating. My time is too precious. But if it means we're going to go into full combat for 10 years, absolutely. I got time.
Well, so if people want to check out your work and the writing that you've done and just what you're up to now, where should they go? Where can they find you online?
Tweet me at, or visit me on Twitter at Christopher Neff.
Chris, thanks so much for joining me. It's so interesting to hear about your work.
Oh, thanks, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Chris for joining me. For my recommendation this week, take a look at one of the films he mentioned, Billy's Hollywood Screen Kiss. As it was for Chris, this movie was pretty important for me. It was one of my first looks at grown-up gay life, a cute little romance about a 20-something gay man doing his best to figure out how love works. One of the most noteworthy things about the film is that the lead is played by Sean P. Hayes, Jack from Will and Grace before he got famous and long before he came out, but it's also a tidy little snapshot of gay life in the 90s. It's a time capsule of flirting before smartphones, getting into a relationship before marriage equality. I watched this movie on VHS over and over as a 17 and 18-year-old, fascinated by the life that would await me, but also aware that it was, of course, just a movie and probably not a completely accurate portrayal. But this movie wasn't going for realism. It's got a character who talks directly to the audience and glamorous old Hollywood fantasy sequences recreating classic films. Looking back, I think it was those moments of fantasy that captured my attention the most. I felt like it gave me permission to envision my own fantasies about what grown-up gay life would be before I was ready to head out into the world and make it real. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support the show and get some backer rewards. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. And join me for the next live stream on October 10th at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. And check out my podcasts Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag heroes in a world of fantasy. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.